This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivis. So the World Asthma Day is on the 2nd of May, and in conjunction with that, of course, we have two very important people who always come in to talk about asthma with us, consultant chest physicians, Dr. Helmi Hajimaidin and Dr. Sundari Ambikebakan. How are the both of you today?
Very well, thank you, Meera. Good to be back.
Yes.
And, thanks for having us.
Helmi, the last time I spoke to Sundari, we spoke very briefly on telephone about processed meat.
That's
asthma, right.
Right,
remember?
Yes.
Is there much, you just want to recap, processed meat and asthma, is there really much of a link for those of them who didn't quite listen to what you had to say?
I think that was just the one study. I don't think there's been any follow-up data about it. But it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think one of the things we want to highlight today is that asthma triggers are different for everyone. So it's recognizing what your asthma triggers are. And there are people who can eat processed meat and be fine, and there may be somebody who eats processed meat and says, oh my goodness, I'm having an asthma attack. So I think it's different for everybody.
Okay. Dr. Helmi, do you think that, in Malaysia, we're pretty paranoid about what we eat when it comes to asthma and allergies in general, actually?
I think we can be paranoid at times, but sometimes the paranoia is probably a little bit misplaced. So you may be worried about things like, oh my God, I can't drink cold water, or oh my God, I can't go into the rain because it's going to make me cough. But that may not necessarily be applicable to everyone, because like Dr. Sundari was saying, triggers tend to be different depending on the individual. Mm-hmm. And we need to figure out what's appropriate for each individual separately.
Yep. And we have about, 2 million asthmatic patients in Malaysia?
Yeah,
is that number about...
That's about it, right. I mean, I think this data is not very recent.
No, it's about 10 years old.
It's about 10 years old, and it's self-reported. So that's where we feel that, asthma is underreported. We feel it can be misdiagnosed, as we've often talked about, and not recognized is the other issue that we face.
Someone from the Health Ministry said that only 6% of these 2 million asthmatic patients are well controlled. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Basically, if someone needs to use the inhaler more than twice a week, or if they have symptoms that affect their quality of life to the point where they're unable to do something like walking or even sports, anything that you would deem to be normal, or you're waking up at night, you're not sleeping well because of your symptoms, and those are certain things that we look at when we try to determine if someone has got asthma that's controlled or not.
Okay.
So when you say someone's got asthma that's uncontrolled, it means they have these symptoms. But unfortunately, most people seem to think that that's normal, when in fact, what we as doctors and most medical professionals would say, you have scope to improve your control.
But then again, how do you even recognize that these are symptoms of asthma, Dr. Sundari? For an example, persistent coughs, especially at night, could be a possible symptom of asthma.
Yes, it can. And I think this is the thing. People always think asthmatics are wheezy and short of breath. So if I'm coughing, I can't have asthma. But we know that there is a variant of asthma as well called cough variant asthma. And nocturnal cough is quite a common symptom of asthma, normal asthma and cough variant asthma as well. So understanding your symptoms is also very important. And a lot of young people, or especially young adults in their 30s and 40s, can have asthma symptoms and just brush it off. They think, oh, I'm unfit. It's perfectly normal for me to run up a flight of stairs and feel breathless. And then when they start asthma treatment, they suddenly realize, my goodness, I can breathe. So there isn't that, there's a disparity in what they understand as control and just being unfit. They think, a lot of people think, oh, I'm unfit. That's why I'm not breathing or wheezing.
In fact, that brings us to the point of exercise-induced asthma, because yeah, that's another factor that, or another entity that we don't really recognize. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people put it down to the fact that, oh, I'm unfit, or, it's normal to feel breathless after a certain period of time.
Exactly.
But actually, there's this entity that we recognize quite often, especially in our day-to-day practice of exercise-induced asthma.
So, like, intensive exercise can trigger an asthma attack?
Not even necessarily intensive exercise. It could be just running up the stairs. It could be being on the treadmill for 5 minutes. Classically, it's people who go swimming as well, because it's not just the fact that you're exerting yourself physically, but you're inhaling more frequently. And in the case of a swimming pool, you're inhaling things like chlorine and other things around you that will further irritate your airways.
Okay.
But again, this can be managed, and people with exercise-induced asthma can still exercise.
But you need to recognize it first.
Exactly. Right. And it needs to be treated.
Okay. And exactly. Who do we see? I mean, do you see a GP? Do you come and see a chest physician like the both of you? You know, who would be the first point of contact?
I think for everywhere in the world, your first point of contact is always your GP. And most GPs are good at recognizing asthma symptoms. But I think sometimes patients need a lot more convincing about using treatment and using inhalers. And that's when we come into the fray, because a lot of times you do get referrals from GPs saying, dear doctor, I think this patient has asthma. I've started up on the inhaler therapy and they haven't improved. And they come into your clinic, and when you have the conversation with the patient, yes, they've had the inhaler treatment. They've taken it for 3 days, but you know what? It didn't make me better. So I've stopped taking it, doctor. You must have something else to give me, you know?
Or just as commonly they say, oh, the GP said I've got asthma, but really it's not, isn't it?
Yes. So, why is it? Why are we in such denial when it comes to asthma?
A lot of
people... It almost feels like a failure on our part.
Yes, exactly. Know? A lot of people seem to feel that having an inhaler in their hand is a sign of weakness. One of the reasons why we've been very heavy into patient education and advocacy is because we've come across so many situations whereby patients come to us and say things like, oh, saya tak mau pakai inhaler sebab nanti rasa macam lemah ataupun akan ketagih. You know, these kind of things that unfortunately has got no bearing with reality.
You could possibly get addicted to it, is
you
that
can't,
what they're
exactly.
saying?
So, but a lot of people
that's
feel
the,
that they
the misconception.
The misconception. And then there's a bit of a stigma as well. Like, I've had sports people come to me and say things like, oh, I can't be seen using this because it just shows that I'm weak. I don't want my coach to feel that, you know, I can't perform as well as I should. And similarly, if you do that in even an office setting, you kind of feel a bit more self-conscious about the fact that you're needing something to do something as basic as breathing. So it's really our job to try and make people understand why this is normal and why this is something that we can actually control over time.
For professional sportsmen or sportswomen who use the inhalers, and I was reading and I just have to pick your brain on this, is it a performance enhancer in any way?
That's a good question. I think with inhaled steroids, I don't think you can call it a performance enhancer. I think with inhaled steroids, it controls your asthma and it allows you to perform at the level you would normally perform.
The important thing, though, is there are certain limits to it.
That's right.
So I can't remember the body's names, the World, it's WADA, I think, the mm-hmm. World Drug Association or something?
WADA.
WADA. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So WADA has got certain limits yes. in place, and basically you need to have very stringent measures put in place with regards to diagnosis, with regards to being given a proper prescription. So you basically need to justify why you're on it, and you need a doctor, not just any physician, not even any chest physician, but someone who's professionally trained to actually diagnose and maintain these things at a professional standards. So those guys will be able to sort of sign you off to say that, yes, you can use these inhalers, because it's not just the steroids, but it's also the beta agonist,
the bronchodilator as okay. well, that opens up the airways. But they are under strict, stringent guidelines, as Dr. Helmy said. And I think all that's pre-approved and submitted. I think the issues arise when it's discovered and people say, oh, I have allergies and I've taken steroids and my doctor prescribed it. That's when you have come into problems, or that's when sports people come into problems.
But that's interesting, because this only shows that you can still continue sports on a professional level, even if you're asthmatic.
Oh, definitely. We have Absolutely. Very famous sports people around the world, especially David Beckham.
Yes.
So he's meant to have asthma, and he's, you know, I wouldn't say he's the best footballer in the world.
Are you sure it's safe to walk out of this building after
yeah,
this?
And there's Paula Radcliffe, the marathon runner as well. And she's asthmatic as well. So, you know, they're both high achievers in sport.
So more locally, we have someone called Welton Sin. So he's one of our national swimmers. And I recall reading an article about how he took up swimming specifically because he had asthma. And I think the story goes along the lines of his parents getting him into swimming lessons up to a point where he represented Malaysia at the Olympics in Rio. So that goes to show that, you know, it's not really a limitation. In fact, in this case, it was a driver to him to actually perform better.
But could it be a limitation for some people?
I think we've often said we've never, ever stopped people from sport who are asthmatic. We've always encouraged them. And if their asthma is particularly bad when they exercise, we try and find ways and means to control it. And I don't think in all my years of treating asthmatics, quite some time now, actually, showing my age.
It isn't looking the
same. Don't even go there, Sundari.
I've recognized that exercise is a trigger for asthma, but we've always been able to manage it. And actually, when asthmatics exercise, it is so much better for them. It really is. It improves their lung capacity, improves their lung function, and achieves better control.
Okay. One of the things I always get is our parents coming to me, asking for letters to excuse their kids from sports activities, extracurricular activities. And I always have a bit of mixed feelings with regard to that, because for me, they should be doing the opposite. They should actually get the kids out, get them to do more. Because once again, like Dr. Sundari was saying, it actually enhances your lung capacity.
Let's try and understand. How does it enhance your lung capacity?
By virtue of allowing you to build up your stamina, it actually helps with regards to increasing the actual physical capacity of your lungs. And more importantly, I think there's also an element of confidence in it, because sometimes you see kids who get labeled with asthma, and rather than them controlling the disease controls them in terms of what they do, in terms of the quality of life. And I would like people to get away from that, because ultimately, as with most conditions, you should be the one who's controlling it, in the sense that you allow it to, you know, be in the background, but it shouldn't stop you from doing your day-to-day activities.
Okay, we're discussing asthma. When we come back, we'll find out more about it's a non-communicable disease and how it actually narrows the air passages. And that's exactly what Dr. Sundari and Dr. Hermia are saying. What exercise does for you is that it opens up the air passages instead. So that's we'll find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. Next week is World Asthma Day. We're finding out a lot more about asthma with Dr. Sundari Ambikipakkan. She's a consultant chest physician, and Dr. Helmi Hajamaidin, consultant chest physician as well. Now, the both of you are instrumental in setting up what we call Asthma Malaysia. What was the objective, Dr. Sundari? And I think we spoke about this last year, but it hadn't really taken off. It was almost there. It was almost there, but not quite.
I think it's been in the making for about 4 years now. And I think the main driver for Asthma Malaysia was when we're in the UK, you got very used to seeing organisations like Asthma UK, which was a national asthma charity which funded research into asthma as well as a patient advocacy movement. And as doctors, it was a useful resource for us and for our patients. And when I came back to Malaysia to start working, we realised that there was a real gap. And I kept hearing stories, and stories very close to home as well, friends telling me stories of how they'd lost loved ones to asthma. And a very dear friend whose mum was working, was at home, and actually, I think, frying sulphur because there had been some snakes in the garden. And so she was frying sulphur, apparently to put the sulphur out. And it triggered a severe asthma attack. And by the time they rushed her into hospital, she was dead. And that really struck me, because it's frying sulphur is not something you hear about in the UK. Yes. So obviously this is something we do here.
Or snakes.
You know.
I didn't know you fried it.
Something of it. But it the fumes came up and obviously just hit her. And by the time she came in, it was too late. And I think I felt more and more that we needed to have a real awareness about asthma, triggers, how to control it. And then Dr. Helmi came back a year after me, and it was much easier when you have somebody else who believes just as much as you do about the importance of asthma. Because, you know, it's not cancer. It's things like that are very emotive.
It's not sexy.
People say it's just asthma, and they underplay it. And for me and for Helmi, I think we both feel very strongly that you shouldn't die from asthma. Mm-hmm. This is not a condition you should die from. Nobody should die from asthma.
But that sulfur incident, was that a rare incident?
That was a rare trigger. But then there are other less rare triggers. There are people who undertreat their asthma. They walk around taking their Ventolin inhaler every day or 3 to 4 times a day, and then suddenly something happens and they get a massive attack and they present themselves at the emergency department and it's too late. You know, so there are lots of it's a small proportion. We're not saying that there are people dying of asthma attacks every day, but the fact is that it is a condition where you shouldn't even have a small proportion of people dying from asthma because the treatment is effective and the treatment controls asthma. And when people say, I have bad asthma, it's not bad asthma, it's uncontrolled asthma. When you talk about truly refractory asthma, the population of patients with asthma that is very hard to treat, that's less than 5% of the total asthma population. And this is why we both felt the need for an organization like Asthma Malaysia to just create awareness, a sense of awareness amongst the asthma population going, oh, you know what? There is a resource. We can go to it. We can have a look. We can find out more about asthma. We can find out more about asthma for our children, understand a little bit more about the disease, and more importantly, go and ask our doctors and say, you know what? I went to this website and found out this information, and I want to know more about asthma and what I've got. So really empowering people to ask questions about asthma, questions about their treatment, you know, and having those discussions. Really, it's opening up a conversation, and that's what we hope Asthma Malaysia will do. Open up a conversation amongst our patients, but hopefully also on a more national level, you know, raising awareness of the importance of this chronic disease.
Funny you mentioned the UK, because despite advocacy groups and all of that, still up to one in three adults who think they have asthma might not actually suffer from that condition. And what does that mean, Dr. Hilmi? Think you have asthma? I mean, what is that?
Well, it boils down to education and awareness as well. And in this case, not necessarily just with patients, but amongst healthcare professionals as well. Now, not everyone who wheezes has asthma, for example. But if you look at children, for example, the moment someone wheezes, they think, oh my God, it's asthma. And that may not necessarily be the case. It may be bronchitis. It may be a temporary chest infection. So people may be mislabeled or misdiagnosed just as easily as being underdiagnosed. And once again, it's a combination of being aware of what kind of symptoms patients come with, but also having an idea of how to diagnose them through various investigations. That's where secondary care help comes into play. So if your primary care doctors, your GPs, are unable to identify people appropriately, then you can refer them on. One of the reasons why we've been taking a bit of time to get Asthma Malaysia going is because we wanted to be very comprehensive in our approach as well. So things like you mentioned with regards to misdiagnosis over and under, we try to address as much as we can. Similarly, we want to make sure that when the website goes live, hopefully next month, everything is covered with a high degree of accuracy. So when you bring that conversation away from home to your doctor, you're coming with a degree of knowledge that is up to date, that's evidence-based, and it's not just based on, you know, what your friends tell you, which is generally what we tend to see these days.
Okay, like use your sister's Ventolin.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Right.
Just
exactly.
Take a puff of it.
Take a puff of it. Exactly.
But do you think, Dr. Sundri, that patients in Malaysia are getting the basic care that they need for asthma?
That's a tricky question, Meera. That's a tricky question. When you say basic care, I think people recognize asthma. It goes back to the delivery of the care, where it starts, you know, so, and it goes back to the communication with the patient. I think, to be fair, a lot of people who get diagnosed with asthma do get given at least a Ventolin inhaler. So they get a preventer inhaler. A reliever inhaler, sorry. And so what we worry is that people walk around with these reliever inhalers, but they don't get a preventer. And so a lot of people think this blue Ventolin is the treatment for asthma. So they think, I feel breathless, I'm going to take a puff of my Ventolin. Ooh, I feel better. It's okay, I'll carry on now. But the next day, the same thing happens, or a week later, the same thing happens. And what is not happening is a lot of people don't get the preventer inhaler. And the preventer inhaler is a key component of asthma treatment because it prevents you from getting those symptoms of breathlessness and wheezing.
So just take a step back. So asthma, at the end of the day, is basically a condition where your lungs are more sensitive to triggers around you. And that happens as a result of there being some degree of inflammation, so there's swelling within the airways. And the preventer inhalers that Dr. Sundari mentioned are inhalers that work on the inflammation, so it reduces the inflammation. Mm-hmm. So over time, that's the inhaler that's going to help you get control, help you feel better, whereas the reliever inhalers tend to be those that temporarily just open things up. But ultimately, it works for about a few minutes, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes. But then you go back to where you were before until the next trigger comes along.
Okay. So the preventer one would seem like it's quite key, and which is what people are not getting.
But again, it's not necessarily the fault of the first doctors that see them, or a non-specialist, say, chest physician who sees a patient, a GP or a general physician. Because the moment they introduce the idea of the inhaler, what patients tend to say is, oh, can I have a tablet? Or can I just have a nebulizer, right? So that puts a doctor in a bind sometimes because they say, well, the patient's not going to take the inhaler.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is the tablets, when you think about it, when you have an asthma attack, it's an airway narrowing. You want medications that's delivered directly to the airway. So that's what inhalers do. They target the airways directly. If you take a tablet, and commonly, instead of using a reliever like Ventolin inhaler, people are given Ventolin tablets. Now, Ventolin tablets just don't work, really. They just make, they have more side effects than they actually have bronchodilator or white opening up your airways, basically.
And neither one of us knew it existed, so we came back to Malaysia.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. We did not, because we've never used it in our practice.
In fact, I thought someone was joking when they told me, oh, this guy's on Ventolin tablets. I was like, haha, you made a mistake. I'm like, nope, I did not.
So, you know, okay. It was not something. I think I spoke to my pharmacist and I said, what sort of witchcraft is this? You know, what is this Ventolin tablet? You okay, because people come in shaking. They have tremors because of the side effects of the tablet. Has it done anything for the airways? No.
The other thing about nebulizers, people do seem to have a perception that nebulizers are better. But once again, nebulizers, the medication that goes into nebulizers are the reliever type. So it's something that provides temporary relief, but ultimately doesn't help you in the long run.
Okay. So it's not a preventer.
It's necessary for an acute attack.
Mm-hmm.
But in the long run, you need the preventer.
Okay. Speaking of witchcraft, I'm sure a lot of people come in. We live in Malaysia, my goodness. Complementary. Alternative treatment. I hear people ingesting all sorts of stuff to control their asthma. It's unbelievable.
I think you need Dr. Helmy to answer
this
one.
Go ahead,
he's
Dr.
passionate
Helmy.
About this.
Passionate?
Most doctors are, actually.
I'm just trying to think of the best way to put this across diplomatically.
You don't have to.
I don't have to, no. But we can't cuss and stuff. No. I suppose, once again, it goes back to education. So most people want an easy way out. And it doesn't just apply to asthma. It applies to cancer, heart disease, diabetes. Yeah. Someone comes along and says, you take this and you'll be fine. Or you go to a chiropractor and then he says, oh, I just need to, you know, change the alignment of certain things and your asthma will be cured. Now, if something's too good to be true, it probably is. That's kind of, I think, a basic concept in medicine. There is no such thing as anything without side effects. It's all about balancing the benefit you get from things versus the possible disadvantages. Now, in the case of asthma, basically, the ultimate aim is to get you to a normal level of life, so a good quality of life with the minimum amount of medication. So if you don't need much medication, then that's what we should all aim for. And we need to step down medications as much as we step up. It's extremely easy to whack someone with all kinds of drugs, but it's much more difficult and it's much more intellectually challenging, actually, to actually take people off these things. But people, if they don't understand why they're on inhalers, why they need a preventer, then they will not trust you and they will not understand why you're giving them X, Y, and Z. So they'll then go out and look for alternatives, because somebody else will come along and say, oh, your asthma is caused by, I don't know, what's that thing called?
Charmed.
Charmed. There's a term for it, can't remember.
Pukau
and all that, yes.
The two Indian girls know it.
Thank you, I was about to say it. Hell me. You've been in the UK for too long.
Yes. I'm more used to the, you know, cauldron and the witch's hat and all that.
But when do you know then? I mean, reliever and preventer.
I thought you were going to say, when do I know what pukau?
No. When do you know that your asthma is under control?
When you don't have to think about it anymore, really. I'll give you another example. One of my best friends in medical school was asthmatic from the time she was a child. And when we were in med school, you had the inhalers, but you didn't have the more sophisticated new inhalers that we have now. And her asthma was pretty sensitive. And so sometimes if we went for a long walk up a hill, and if she didn't have a Ventolin inhaler at the top of the hill, she'd be like, you know, wheezing. And, you know, we'd all be panicking. And she'd go, I'll be all right. I'll be all right. I just need my Ventolin. And then she'd go, ooh, I don't have my Ventolin. But today, and for the last 10 years, she's been on a Preventa inhaler. And she's currently a reconstructive surgeon in Toronto. And she does operations for 10 hours, 12 hours. And when she was last here, I said to her, how's your asthma? And she goes, you know, Zind, I don't even think about it anymore. She said, I take 2 puffs of my inhaler in the morning and 2 puffs at night, and that's it. And I've not had an attack in 10 years.
And I bet you if she took tablets, her hands would be too shaky to do any reconstructive surgery.
Exactly. Yeah.
So Preventa inhalers are really for the rest of your life?
Not necessarily. Mm. So asthma, in a way, is a spectrum of symptoms, of conditions. Not everyone has the same type of asthma. So everyone experiences it differently. So just as you increase the medication to a point where things are under control, once things are controlled for a decent period of time, then you try and taper the medication off. Because sometimes it may be seasonal. For example, back in the UK, it tends to be something that occurs every springtime because pollen fills up in the air, people become a bit more sensitive. Over here, we saw a lot of cases when it was particularly hazy. So during those periods of time, you might need more medication. You might have people who are normally okay, who develop some degree of sensitivity. But then once that period passes, you may then go back to not having any medication. But just as some people are on medication for too long a period of time, generally, the problem we have is people who do not think that it's necessary to be on inhalers for a decent period of time, and they stop too early.
Okay. Speaking of weather, environmental factors in Malaysia that could trigger asthma attacks, the haze being one, are there any others? And the reason I ask you is because there was something called thunderstorm asthma that occurred in Melbourne.
Dr. Sundari's favourite topic.
Yeah, please tell me about that. I mean, some people died as a result of that.
So thunderstorm asthma, as you read, it was recognized, they had an article in Australia. But actually, I think the first recognition of it was actually in the UK when they found that there was a whole bunch of patients that suddenly pitched up to the ED, one in two hospitals in the Cambridge area. And when they investigated, they went to the environmental agency, is it?
DEFRA, I think.
Yeah. And they said, you know, what was in the air last night? And they discovered that it was a pollen called Alternaria. So when lightning strikes, this pollen gets thrown up into the air, and susceptible patients, not all asthmatics, susceptible asthmatics get severe asthma, a severe asthma attack. Now, I'm not sure whether we have Alternaria in Malaysia, if I'm honest.
I don't know, no.
But I have to say, I have seen in this rainier season that we've had, we've had a lot more asthmatics come in with uncontrolled asthma. So whether it's the same sort of mold or whether it's a different one, I'm not entirely sure. But yes, it is a very real phenomenon.
Okay, so it's the same thing that happened in Melbourne as well?
I think it's the same thing that happened in Melbourne.
And you don't necessarily need to have one specific type of mold or spore.
Yeah.
It could be any form of air pollutant.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, with regards to World Asthma Day, the theme for this year is better air, better breathing. Mm-hmm. Because up to a point, there are things that we can't control when it comes to asthma. You can't, you know, nobody knows why some people have more sensitive airways compared to others.
That's right.
But when it comes to things like air quality, pollution, smoking, all these things are generally human-made. You know, it's driven by industrial activities, it's driven by government energy policies, it's driven by government tobacco control policies. So all these things are things that we can control. And unfortunately, Malaysia, you know, as you can see outside your window right now, it's not particularly clear. And the air that we have is very variable.
So that's why I have a problem with this theme, because I can't see us breathing better air, really.
Not immediately, but in the long run, and we have plenty of ways to try and push the conversation to a different level.
Which is?
So, for example, Asthma Malaysia itself, the idea is to get more education out there, patients who are more empowered. And at the very basic level is understanding what asthma is. But once we get through that first phase of people understanding what asthma is, then the next phase should be, okay, what can we do to lobby the appropriate policies to speak to the appropriate government officials to say that, hey, actually, us breathing clean air is actually a human right. So, you know, industrial policies aside, it has to be something that's sustainable, something that's going to help us in the long run, not just for our generation, but for our generation after this. And if you look at what China is doing, for example, they've come to a realization very much earlier than most industrialized countries that all the efforts they've put in to create factories, to create this industrialized nation, has created a scenario where if you go to Beijing or Shanghai today, you can see the persistent smog that's just hanging in the air. Yeah. And as a result, they have extremely high numbers of asthmatic, extremely high numbers of patients with very hyperreactive airways. And as a result of that, their government is now taking steps to actually change their climate policy, sorry, their industrial policy to address climate change. That is something that we can do in the long run. Granted, it's not something that's going to happen overnight. No. But as with most governments, they tend to follow what voters ask for, and voters with the loudest voices tend to be heard the most.
I'm just so pleased you're an optimist, Dr. Helen, because Rome, I'm not convinced as yet.
Rome wasn't built in a day.
Never. Both of you, really. In terms of research, at least, is there anything new coming out as far as asthma management is concerned?
There was a study not too long ago, I think it was in the papers either earlier this year or late last year, on a new type of drug called calcilytix. But basically, it's a different pathway that they've looked to decrease the inflammation. It's on mouse studies, but basically the mice that had this particular drug given to them and was in a form of an inhaler as well, they had less asthmatic symptoms. Now, what works with mice might not necessarily work with human beings, yes. But it's an interesting first step, and the sort of science behind it sounds quite sound. So hopefully that will bring in an entirely new class of drugs that will allow us to address asthma at a higher, greater level.
A possible cure, Dr. Sundri?
Nothing in the offing, I'm afraid. I think a lot of asthma research as well at the moment is actually very geared towards patients' perceptions of asthma and their control, because that's what researchers are trying to understand as well, saying, well, the doctor may feel one thing, what does the patient feel? And how do we address these things? So there's a lot of patient-centered research at the moment. And also there's a lot of research to sort of identify, if you like, different asthmatics. As we said, it's a spectrum of disease. And so what a lot of research is saying, you know, don't bundle all asthmatics into one category. Look at them and see where they fit in. Are they cough variant? Are they mild asthmatics? Are they moderate? Are they allergic? You know, as in, are they very sensitive to certain allergens? Because the treatments are slightly different and can be targeted appropriately. So I think that's the big trend in research at the moment.
In fact, for Asthma Malaysia, two of our international advisors are Professor Martin Partridge and Professor Josip Kar. So Martin is a professor at the Imperial College who specializes not just in respiratory medicine, but in patient-centered care. And Josip is a WHO advisor on issues with regards to patient management, with regards to mHealth and social media. So this is kind of the things that we are trying to look at as well, because as things progress, as time progresses, there'll be more and more use of things like mHealth, Internet of Things. These are the issues that we have to deal with, and these are the things that we have to look into as means to actually get patients to understand their disease better and also control things better.
Yeah, and from the mobile phone, I think that's a really powerful tool at
Absolutely.
The moment, isn't
yeah.
it? And nearly every one of us has one. Mm-hmm. Would you have a message, Dr. Helmy, on this World Asthma Day?
Diplomacy. I think, once again, going back to the theme of asthma, not just for this year, but previously, the most important thing is, yes, it's not something that we can cure, but it's something very controllable. And the idea is to get to a point where you don't have to think about it.
I think for me, it's getting patients to recognize triggers. And as I've said so many times on BFM, please use your inhalers.
Both of them, not just one.
Not just one.
Exactly. Okay, how do we get in touch with you? The Asthma Malaysia website?
There's the Asthma Malaysia website. We hope will be live next month. But we have a Facebook page, Asthma Malaysia. And we also have an email address, which is asthma.mas@gmail.com.
Fantastic.
So if you have any questions, interests, or if you want to provide funding for our upcoming nonprofit, by all means, email us.
Wonderful. Thank you both very much for joining us today. Chest physicians Dr. Sundri Ambike Parkin and Dr. Helmy Hajimaidin. This World Asthma Day on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.